Welcome everyone to one of our BJJ podcasts for the month of April. I'm Andrew Duckworth and a warm welcome back to you all from your team here at the Bone & Joint Journal. I'd like to start by thanking all of you for your continued comments and support, as well as a big thanks from myself and our team to our many authors and colleagues who have taken part in the series, which highlights just some of the great work published each month here in the journal. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming back our editor-in-chief here at the BJJ to discuss their paper from University College London entitled A Prospective Randomized Controlled Trial Comparing CT-Based Planning with Conventional Total Hip Arthroplasty versus Robotic Arm-Assisted Total Hip Arthroplasty, which has been published in the April edition of the BJJ. Welcome, Prof. It's great to have you back with us as always.
Andrew, thank you. And it's great to be with you as ever.
Really interesting paper, you know, that was published this month from your centre. You know, the primary objective of this study was to compare the reproducibility of the planned preoperative centre of hip rotation, or the core, in patients undergoing robotic arm-assisted THA versus conventional THA. And you looked at a variety of other outcomes as well, sort of acetabular component orientation, restoration of offset and leg length, and functional outcomes and problems, which I know we'll come on to. But just as a start, Prof, for our listeners, can you give us sort of a brief overview, sort of setting the scene, really, if you will, for this RCT on the current robotic hip literature and how this sort of trial came about for you?
Yeah, no, thank you. And this is, I should say at the outset, you know, I'm here talking to you, but a trial like this takes a lot of people and a lot of work, and particularly Jenny Tamasebi in the background and Andres Fontalis and Baba Kayani working hard at the front end have all delivered what I think is a very useful study. I mean, in reality, there's two aspects to this worth thinking about. The first is that robotics and hip surgery have existed for some time, but the previous generation of robots really didn't deliver good outcomes and very much went into abeyance. And suddenly we've got new technology that seems to be promising and has baseline data that was attractive to us. It's the ability to plan on a CT scan in three dimensions, which has become more and more attractive, both in hip preservation and in hip arthroplasty and in hip revision, is now with us. And the ability to execute with haptics and with a robotic arm, again, seemed to have very good preliminary data. So we were at a stage where we had access to a technology that we could really start to evaluate against the standard and start to study. Yeah. And beyond that, there is this misconception that hip replacement is sorted out and it is a perfect operation and everybody does well. Well, the reality is that not everybody does that brilliantly. We know there's a significant proportion of our patients who have ongoing pain or are not completely satisfied with their intervention. We know that from PROMS data. We know that from registry data and from a number of studies that we've described previously in the journal. We also know that our demographic for hip replacement is changing. We're getting a younger and younger, more demanding population who really want to be active. They don't just want pain relief. They want to do sport. They need a perfect as can be hip replacement. And even our older patients now want to be active. So in reality, we face an expanding need in a more demanding set of patients. And in order to deliver that, we need to probably up our game in terms of restoring anatomy and restoring biomechanics. And bear in mind, for all those who think that hip replacement is solved, we're still hearing and seeing about patients with instability, leg length inequality, all those related problems that are essentially solved by improved surgery. Yeah. So I think there's a lot to attract us to doing studies to try and to see whether this technology will help us.
Yeah, no, absolutely, probably. And I think that's really a nice summary of how it's laid out in your study in terms of that sort of multifactorial reasons of why this is important. I think that one of the key ones there is, like you say, is that we presume it's a perfect operation and it is a very good operation, but there's a lot to be gained from. And I think, as you say, with caveating with that, is that our patients do demand more now, and not in a bad way. It's a good thing, you know, and that makes us strive for better, doesn't it, as well? And, you know, I was looking at the exponential increase you quote in the paper from the American Joint Replacement Registry of the, you know, an 18.3% annual increase in procedural volume in 2020. I mean, that's amazing. You know, that's a huge increase, and that just increases the demand, but also it means that we need to do better, don't we? And we should always strive to do better with all our technologies, really.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't know whether the anti-obesity drugs are going to change the game. I doubt it. I suspect they'll bring more patients into the realm, but only time will tell.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if we move on to the sort of study design, it's a prospective randomized control trial, which we've alluded to, that included 60 patients, 30 in each arm with symptomatic hip OA, undergoing conventional THA versus robotic arm assisted. So Prof, very, very briefly, just the inclusion exclusion criteria for the study, obviously very important for any RCT like this. What were those?
So in reality, what we wanted is a group of patients who are relatively homogeneous. So they had to have osteoarthritis, they had to be adults between the age of 18 and 80, or they kind of we landed in the 60s as an average, as which is what we see in our population. And above all, we wanted them to be suitable for the implants that were used with this technology. In fact, with a lot of the robotic platforms, and the hip and the knee are closed platforms, with this particular design, you can use either a cementless or a cemented stem, but for uniformity, we wanted patients that were suitable for a cementless stem based on our templating and our planning. So those patients were selected. One of the, you'll face this yourself as well in studies, one of the big issues is making sure you can actually study your patient population. We wanted to almost man mark this group of patients and not lose them. So we selected patients who were local, not tertiary referrals, not ones from far away, and ones that could easily access the hospital, were mobile enough, and obviously were happy to comply and consent to the study and join us on this journey. So I think it is pretty tight. It's just a fairly homogeneous group.
Absolutely. And so you alluded to there, what about the preoperative imaging and planning, that, and as well as the surgical protocol, that was fairly standardized as well, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So I think, I mean, the first thing is, what we really want to do is remove a lot of the variables here, because if you go from conventional to robotic surgery, you're changing quite a few things. So what we've done here is everybody had the standard x-rays, everybody had the spinopelvic planning, which we now do routinely, and everybody had the CT scan. And the reason for that is we wanted everybody to start the intervention with a predefined, very clear plan. So there wasn't one advantage to one group over the other. And then we did the intervention, and it was the surgery was either robotic or conventional, same group of surgeons within the same institution doing it according to one pathway. There's only one way things get done on our team. And then essentially followed up in a standardized way with standardized milestones and metrics. And the key thing here is they had a CT at 6 weeks for us to, you know, did we achieve what we set out to achieve? Because ultimately, this is a mechanistic study. This is a study to measure whether we can deliver the target we aimed to deliver. Because actually, if you take a step away from this, one of the big things we're going towards here is, both in the hip and the knee, is being able to define our target for our joint arthroplasty. You know, we were just very happy that we could do joint replacements, but now we've got personalized joint replacements. And if you can then define a target, the ability to hit that target is really important.
No, absolutely. And that really does take us nicely onto your outcomes, because I think it's quite an interesting thing about your primary outcome, the other outcomes you collected, and when these are obtained, Prof, wasn't it, in terms of what you powered the study to?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, this, as I said, this is a kind of mechanistic study. This is a single center study, really trying to look at, can we hit that target? And so we looked at center of rotation, because we'd done our pilot data. In fact, we published our pilot data, as you know, and we had some metrics to go on. And as per a number of case series before, there was a signal that you could actually reproduce center of rotation more easily if you had access to this technology. So now we had, everyone had access to the CT scan, everyone had access to the plan. Could you, by using the robotic arm and executing according to this protocol, actually hit that center of rotation better? Yeah. So we essentially powered this study to our existing data on center of rotation. And that allowed us to study it for that metric.
Absolutely. And obviously you collected various other outcomes, which you've already mentioned, as well as a variety of PROMs, and sort of including the WOMAC, so the WHO score, wasn't it, the Oxford Hip score. There's a range of, and even the UCLA activity score as well. And they were collected, was it preoperatively at 1 year? That's right, isn't it? Is that right?
Absolutely. So we've got, so I think we've published the 1 year data. The patients are still being followed up.
Yeah.
But this is the minimum 1 year follow-up data. And this is not the study that's designed to look at PROMs. You know, there are bigger studies like RACER, which you and I have discussed before on BJJ podcasts, that are multi-center studies that are, you know, powered to look at PROMs. Yeah. This is much more about whether we're hitting the target or not.
Yeah.
I mean, interestingly, my view in the hip is that we're not going to achieve a huge difference in prompts because we do pretty well anyway.
Yeah.
It's the reality is the difference may be a reduction in complications, a reduction in instability and leg length inequality, or the ability to do sport a little bit better. They're more subtle things that standard prompts may not pick up, and they certainly won't pick up as to the extent of an MCID difference.
I totally agree, Prof. And I think that was what I picked up from this and I liked, is that you're sort of actually, if you can hit that target and if you can just squeeze those outliers more into the middle, it's actually, because you won't, like you say, you won't pick that up on average of a prom, will you, at all?
No, that's true. And everybody has good days and bad days. And the whole idea is to get rid of those outliers for everybody.
Absolutely. So if we move on to obviously briefly what you found, because I want to spend a bit of time on obviously what the implications of it. So a total of 60 patients completed the study, as we said. The mean age of study cohort was 64 years and a roughly equal number of males and females. And as you'd expect, the sort of overall baseline characteristics, demographic data between the group was comparable in the study. So Prof, in terms of the primary outcome, restoration of the native horizontal core, what did you find?
Essentially, we found that we were significantly more likely to hit that center of rotation using the robotic arm than we were without.
Yeah.
And that clearly reached statistical significance. We're talking about a few millimeters. So I think we could question whether there is a clinical significance to this. But if you compound that with the fact that then you look at your vertical center of rotation, and again, we're better at getting vertical center of rotation. We're better at getting offset right. We're better at getting acetabular version right. So I think if you add one to the other, there eventually it will reach something that may lead to consequences.
And that's right. That's how I actually interpret it, Prof, is that actually you're getting marginal gains in all these things, which eventually could add up to a bigger gain in terms of, like you say, about acetabular component orientation, combined offset, leg length, all these things seem to improve. And I know we've mentioned already it's not powered for it, but in terms of sort of surgical characteristics, PROMs, safety profile complications, how did they compare?
Pretty similar. So essentially, you know, as a patient population coming through, when you look at their complications, when you look at the safety profile, they were the same. We haven't seen an increase in problems or because we've used the robotic arm and put pins in the pelvis to mount the arrays and so on. We haven't seen an increase in infections. We haven't seen an increase in fractures or anything like that from that point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we go on to the implications, Prof, you know, I mean, I think the strengths of the RCT, you know, of the study are really clear, you know, and obvious, you know, as you say in the paper, it's been the first RCT to explore the impact of robotics on clinical and radiological outcomes in total heart pathopathy. You know, a comprehensive assessment of various technical objectives as well as the functional outcomes and the problems that you've looked at. But what sort of your take-home message, or how do you interpret these findings? And I think I'm quite interested to know, is it what you expected with your experience with robotics?
So, I mean, I think this is what we felt would happen, because you suddenly find, as do your physios, as do your nurses, that you're sort of doing something different and it feels a little bit easier and a little bit better and a little bit more reproducible. Now, that's often, you blame yourself for that. You think, actually, I'm biased because I like new technologies. I like the fact that I have access to this. But actually, it kind of, even though that bias pre-existed, this is a way of looking at it objectively. And objectively, we seem to be hitting the target we aimed for a lot better. And I think that does translate to patients who are slightly more comfortable, get mobile a little bit more quickly. And for example, in this study, even though the milestones and needs for physiotherapy were defined completely objectively based on set criteria, there was less physiotherapy outpatient usage from the robotic arm group. Yeah. So there are little signals here that are starting to creep in. And I think only reproducing these studies, doing them on a larger scale, seeing if they translate to other centers, will eventually determine whether that leads to cost effectiveness, whether that leads to really true added value on a population level. But certainly for us, for me as a surgeon, this makes me a better surgeon. It makes me a more comfortable surgeon. And it reassures me that I'm putting the hip where I want to put it, and I'm minimizing the risks of things like instability and leg length inequality for my patients.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You highlight a point there, Prof, I was interested in, is once you've done robotic surgery and you've got your through the learning curve and things, you've got a handle on it, does it make you better when you do a conventional joint replacement? Because you have a feel of where it should be, in inverted commas, if you see what I mean.
I think it does help. I think it's a little bit like having that sense check, particularly for things like leg length. If you're training someone and you say, look at this number, feel where it is, and then you come back to it. Look at this offset, look at the soft tissue envelope, see what the soft tissue balance looks like. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really interesting. And you mentioned it as well there about cost. I know we've discussed this before, but obviously you have not done a cost analysis as part of this study, which is clear. How do you think that's going to pan out in the future?
So I think, look, the cost analysis is coming, as other studies will repeat as well. There's no doubt there is an added front end cost to getting the technology. Yeah. There's added imaging with the technology, and there are disposables.
Yeah.
But it will all come down to, in the long run, to the healthcare costs that come thereafter. So length of stay, outpatient visits, physio, and then ultimately revisions. Because actually, if we take a wider lens, this RCT, and in fact, probably even studies like RACER are unlikely to capture what the big data studies are showing, which is that instability risk is dramatically decreased if you're using this technology. So two big North American institutions looking at all their data have seen a fourfold reduction in hip dislocation when they're using CT-based planning and robotics. So it's when you look at cost overall, including revisions, including reoperations, that's the bit that really will pan out. Right now, there's no doubt there's an added expense.
Yeah.
And those are the analysis. So we're currently exploring the health economic side of all the number of RCTs that we've done. But, you know, I think the front end costs will decrease over time.
Yeah.
And we will start to learn what the true implications over time in terms of the longevity of the implants, complications, re-intervention. So we still don't know. The bottom line is we really don't know.
No, but that is interesting, bro. That big data work of fourfold. I mean, revisions, as we know, cost so much that actually that could have massive implications overall, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think we need to go over time and pick that up. And therein lie a few other problems in that, you know, does the data from HSS or from our center translate to everyone else? Because everyone uses technology slightly differently. Mm. So that, you know, that makes it slightly trickier in terms of measuring these things. And then the other piece, which we're going to struggle with so far, is our own registry in this country going to be able to pick up these cases?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense.
So I think we hope they will, but...
Yeah, absolutely. And so you sort of maybe touched on this, but just to finish up, you know, what do you feel we've discussed the strengths of your trial. Do you feel there's any sort of limitations or anything you'd want to highlight, you know, sort of as sort of caveats with regards to it at all?
Absolutely. I mean, so I think, you know, the first thing to say, it's a small study. This is a small single center mechanistic study. This was an investigator initiated study, but it is funded by industry. So I think people have to always, there are always conflicts of interest. Mm. I think the reality is if it's an RCT, it's transparent, the data's there, people can look at it, but nevertheless, it will be accused of being conflicted on that basis. But above all, it's a small study in a specialist center. Mm-hmm. And whether that will be replicated elsewhere, you know, only time will tell. I think it's important that we now look at bigger numbers and see that. Probably the other thing to say is that we are now repeating this study, but using the functional positioning software.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the most interesting things about robotics is the ability to adjust based on the spinopelvic relationship to decrease impingement. And that wasn't available when we started this particular study. So this study was aiming for a target to get coverage and accurate positioning. And the next study will be functional positioning. So that would be really interesting.
That is really interesting. And you know, and just to finish off, you know, you've already alluded to it. What other data do you think we need in this area? Where's the next sort of steps forward, do you think?
I think we need the multi-center studies, if only to see about the translation. But ultimately, I think the real thing we need is the registry data.
Yeah.
We need to start seeing what the impact of these technologies are on registry data. And I think we've got to remember here again, it's less of a problem right now in the hip than in the knee. Is there are multiple devices, multiple technologies. And so we're going to have to pick up the impact of each one. So we're going to have to be careful on how we look at the data. But ultimately, we've got to see that there is an impact at population level.
Absolutely. Well, probably that's great. I think that's a nice place for us to finish up. And, you know, congratulations on, I think, Arinka, a really great study, an outstanding study. It's clearly a very important addition to the literature in this area. And I really, as always, it's great to have you with us. And thank you for taking the time to join us.
Well, no, thank you very much. Really enjoyed talking to you about it.
And to our listeners, we do hope you've enjoyed joining us. And we encourage you to share your thoughts and comments about our podcast and the paper on social media and the like. And feel free to post about anything we've discussed here today. And thanks again for joining us. Take care, everyone.